through the woods to the open fields around his house. His walk through the forest seemed even more like Southeast Asia, now that he knew he was not alone out here in the bush. It occurred to Clark that he'd have to break out of the woods right in front of open pasture land in order to get to his house. If there were hunters there, especially the kind of hunters who trespassed and killed game out of season, then, John recognized, it was not beyond the realm of possibilities that he could get shot a second time this month. And this time it wouldn't be from a 9mm pistol. It would be from a shotgun or a deer rifle. Christ, Clark thought. He reached into his waders, pulled out the SIG pistol that he kept with him at all times, and pointed it to the dirt trail at his feet in order to fire a round to indicate his presence. But he stopped himself before pressing the trigger. No. He wasn't sure why, but he did not want to alert anyone to his presence. He wasn't worried about a group of turkey hunters intentionally turning their weapons on him, of course not. But he didn't know these guys, what their intentions were, or how much Jack Daniels they'd been sipping on their little afternoon hunting sortie, so he decided to track them instead. He headed off the trail he'd been traveling on, so that he could get behind where he thought they would have traveled through the woods. It took him a while to find their tracks. He blamed the low, dappled light here under the trees. Finally, he saw evidence of two men where they crossed a smaller trail. After a few dozen yards, he detected the pattern of their travel, and he found it odd. Whether they were turkey hunters or deer hunters, moving off the trail here didn't make much sense. Their quarry would be out in the open rolling fields closer to the farmhouse. Why were they moving covertly here, still 50 yards from the edge of the tree line? He lost their tracks a few yards on when the dusk and the canopy of evergreen above blocked out all but the faintest traces of usable light. Clark put his fishing tackle down, lowered to his knees, and moved slowly up to the edge of the woodline. He was careful to keep himself low to the ground and shielded by a large hemlock spruce. When he reached the edge of the pasture, he looked out over the low grasses, fully expecting to see bright orange-clad figures to the east. But there was nothing. He scanned over by his farmhouse, a good 100 yards to the north. But he didn't see anyone there, either. But he did see a group of whitetail, 8 in number, nibbling on grasses in the field between his position and the farmhouse. They were small females and young fawns, nothing a hunter would be interested in. Quickly, Clark's brain began computing all the data he'd taken in. The amount of time for the break-free oil to drift down from the natural crossing in the creek to where he found it passing his fording point. The amount of time the deer would stay clear of the field had the hunters crossed here. It didn't take long for him to realize that the hunters were here, in the woods with him. Where? John Clark was not a hunter, not of animals anyway, so he defaulted again to his Vietnam experience. A knoll rose out of the southern portion of the pasture ahead on his right. This is where a sniper would logically set his hide to get optimal coverage of the area. Maybe a hunter would do the same. Yes. There. 50 yards away from where Clark lay, a flash of light where the sunset just over the mountain glinted off glass. Then he saw the men. They were not hunters, this he could tell from here. They wore ghillie suits, head-to-toe camouflage of tied strands of green and brown fabric to simulate leaves and dry grasses. The two men looked like a pair of leaf piles behind a partially camoed rifle and a spotting scope. And their lenses were trained on the farmhouse. What the fuck? Clark whispered to himself. One of the men was wet, this Clark could plainly see. It didn't take a brilliant investigator to put together what happened. These spotters had moved through the bush, crossed the creek 100 yards or so north of where Clark crossed, and the man in the soaked camo had slipped on the flat rocks, dunked himself and his .308 rifle. Gun oil from his weapon would keep it from rusting, but that gun oil had given away the presence of the team to their target. But why am I their target? Clark thought he could backtrack over to his neighbor's house. It would take at least a half hour, but there he could call the authorities, get some Frederick County Sheriff's Department deputies here to deal with the two snipers. But that would draw way too much attention to John Clark himself, inviting questions as to why a pair of military-trained men with a high-powered rifle were on his property. Or he could take care of this himself. Yes, it was the only way. He planned his route back into the trees, then south, behind the knoll, and then he planned his attack on the two men from behind. But he didn't get very far. In the distance, he saw big black vehicles, 5 of them, heading up the road toward his house. They moved fast, without announcing their presence with their headlights, and Clark just lay there and watched them with fascination. From 100 yards away, he watched the big SUVs park around his property front and back. Only then were they close enough for him to see that men in black body armor stood on the running boards, held onto railings on the roofs, and clutched M4 assault rifles with their other hands. He couldn't actually read the white writing on the back of their uniforms and body armor, but he recognized the equipment and the tactics of the men using that equipment. Clark closed his eyes and put his forehead down in the cool leaves. He knew who was smashing the front and back doors of his farmhouse. This was an FBI SWAT team. John lay there motionless and watched the FBI shatter his back door with a battering ram, then charge inside in a tactical train of men. Within seconds, their team leader announced they were clear, and men stepped back outside. "Son of a bitch," John said softly as he backed up, returning to the concealment of the woods. Here he shed his waders and tucked them under a collection of leaves and pine needles. He didn't bother to take too much time on this project. He'd made no attempt to hide his tracks as he walked here through the woods, and he was about to make tracks in the other direction. When the FBI made it over here to the tree line, they'd see evidence that someone had wandered up on their raid and then left the area. After hiding the waders, Clark turned, stood, and began running back up the trail, looking to create some distance between himself and the men after him. He needed to find out what this was all about before he decided what the hell he would do about it. As he ran, more than just about anything, he wished his mobile phone worked right now. He had a sinking suspicion he'd missed an important call or two while out fishing. 41. The press conference was hastily called for the end of the workday at the Robert F. Kennedy Department of Justice building on Pennsylvania Avenue, just off the mall in D.C. There weren't many journalists around the DOJ building at that late hour, but when the news services learned the Attorney General himself would be making an announcement, reporters shot over from the nearby Capitol building and assembled in a conference room not far from A.G. Michael Brannigan's office. At 5:35, more than a half hour late, Brannigan and a pair of his senior staff shuffled into the room. The journalist waited with growing interest in what he had to say. The first indication that something remarkable was going on was when the Attorney General stood at the lectern without speaking for a moment. He looked off to his subordinates a couple of times. Reporters following his eyes saw men on mobile phones in the corner, speaking softly and hurriedly into them. After several seconds of this, of Brannigan watching his men, obviously hoping for something from them, one of the assistant AGs looked up at his boss and shook his head no. Brannigan nodded, showed no outward disappointment, and finally addressed the reporters in attendance.
"Thank you for coming. This afternoon I am announcing that a federal arrest warrant has been issued for one John A. Clark, an American and former employee of the Central Intelligence Agency. Mr. Clark is wanted for questioning for a series of cold case murders spanning several decades, as well as implication in ongoing criminal activity."
The journalists jotted down the name and looked at one another. Brannigan's office had been making threats about going after CIA officers for actions in the field, but nothing much had happened. Was this the beginning, here at the end of Keelty's first term, of the pogrom against the CIA that many had said was long overdue? None of them knew anything about Clark or any case about a CIA spook named Clark, so there were not even any questions as the AG paused. Brannigan had been warned about this and instructed by the White House to let slip the next line.
"Mr. Clark, you may know, is a longtime friend, a confidant, and a former bodyguard of President Jack Ryan, both during Mr. Ryan's tenure in the CIA as well as after. We understand this is a politically charged case, but it is a case we cannot overlook due to the serious allegations against Mr. Clark."
Now the press began to scramble. Websites were opened on smartphones. Questions of clarification were shouted out. A woman from NBC asked when the next update on the case would be given, presumably so she could have time to figure out just what the hell was going on. Brannigan said,
"I expect we'll have something for you within a few hours. As of this moment, Clark is a fugitive from justice, but our dragnet should bring him in shortly."
Brannigan left the conference room, and the reporters followed him out with their phones to their ears. The TV media would have something on the case by the 6 o'clock news. Print had a little more time to get some facts together. Jack Jr. arrived at Melanie's house at 6 o'clock. They had planned on a more formal evening in D.C., but both were tired after a long day at work, so they decided to just get together for a quick and casual dinner instead. When Melanie opened the door to her place, she looked beautiful, But she apologized to Ryan, asked for just a couple more minutes to get ready. Ryan sat on a love seat, looking around the room to occupy himself. He noticed a collection of books and papers stacked on the little desk in the corner next to Melanie's laptop. Books on Pakistan, on Egypt. Printouts full of maps, pictures, and text.
"Still bringing your work home with you, I see," Jack asked with a smile.
"No, that's just some research I'm doing on my own."
"Mary Pat isn't giving you enough to do?"
Melanie laughed.
"That's not it at all. I just like poking around in open source in my free time. There's nothing there that is in any way classified. Just out there for anyone."
"If it's not classified, can I take a look at it?"
"Why, are you interested in terrorism?"
"I'm interested in you."
Melanie laughed, grabbed her coat, and said, "I'm ready when you are." Jack cocked his head slightly, wondered what she had cooking over there by her laptop, but he climbed off the couch and followed the beautiful brunette out the door. 15 minutes later, Jack and Melanie sat at the bar at Murphy's, an Irish pub on King Street, not far from her place. They were halfway into their first beer, and a big basket of Old Bay wings had just been delivered, when the bartender switched to a news channel. The 2 20-somethings ignored it for the most part while they chatted, but Ryan glanced up occasionally. He was hoping to see some new poll numbers for his dad that would allow his parents to breathe a little more easily, so he looked over Melanie's shoulder at the screen from time to time. Melanie was talking about a cat she had in high school when Ryan stole a check of the news. His eyes widened, his mouth dropped open, and he said, "Oh, fuck no." Melanie stopped talking.
"Excuse me?"
Ryan leapt at the remote to the TV, yanked it off the bar, and turned up the volume. The television showed an image of Ryan's colleague, John Clark. The report then switched to Michael Branigan's news conference at DOJ, where Jack caught the AG's vague description of the charges and the political implications of the case. Melanie looked at Ryan while he watched this.
"You know him?"
"He is a friend of my dad's."
"I'm sorry."
"A legend at CIA."
"Really?"
Ryan nodded distractedly.
"He was on the other end. Operations."
"Case officer?"
"SAD.
Melanie nodded. She understood.
"Do you think he...
"Hell no,"
Ryan said, then controlled himself.
"No. The guy has a damn Congressional Medal of Honor."
"Sorry."
Jack turned his head away from the TV, back to Melanie.
"I'm sorry. I'm reacting to what Keelty is doing, not you."
"I get it.
He's got a wife, kids. He's a grandfather."
"Jesus.
You don't tear down a man like that without knowing what you were talking about."
Melanie nodded.
"Can your dad protect him when he gets back in the White House?"
"I hope so. I guess Keelty is doing this to prevent my dad from getting back in the White House."
"It's too transparent. It won't work,"
Melanie said, but her voice trailed off at the end.
"Unless?"
"Unless, well...
you say this Clark doesn't have any skeletons in his closet that weren't put there by his work in the CIA.
And that was it exactly. Jack couldn't say it to Melanie, of course, but he knew a detailed investigation into John Clark just might uncover the campus. Might that be the goal of this? Might some news have come out about what Clark had been up to for the past year or more? Something about the Paris operation or even the Amir case? Shit, Jack thought. This investigation, whether or not they have anything substantive on Clark, could bring about the destruction of the campus. The report ended, and he turned to Melanie. "I'm really sorry, but I need to call it a night."
"I understand,"
she said, but Ryan could see in her eyes that she did not. Where was he going to go? What could he possibly do to help John Clark? 42. Jack Ryan Sr. ate his hamburger before going on stage at the rally at the Tempe Mission Palms Hotel. He planned on just taking a few polite bites. This was a late lunch for him, and he had another event to attend in less than 2 hours, a Veterans of Foreign Wars dinner, also here in Tempe. But the burger was so damned good, he devoured it while chatting with his supporters. He took the stage at 2:35 local time. The crowd was lively and ecstatic with the poll numbers. The polls had tightened since Keelty announced the capture of the man who had killed so many Americans a few years earlier, but Ryan was still ahead and beyond the margin of error. When the music stopped, Jack leaned into the microphone slightly and said,
"Good evening. Thank you. I appreciate it."
The crowd loved him. It was taking them longer than usual to quiet down. Finally, he was able to thank his supporters for showing up this afternoon, and then warn them against letting down their guard too quickly. The election was still 2 weeks away, and he needed support now more than ever. He'd given this same speech for the past 2 or 3 days,
and he'd give it for two or three more. As Ryan addressed his supporters, he looked over the crowd. Off to the right, he caught a glimpse of the back of Arnie Van Damme as he walked out of the hall with his phone to his ear. Jack could tell Arnie was excited about something, but he couldn't tell if it was something good or something bad. Van Damme disappeared behind a mountain of balloons just before exiting the hall. Ryan began closing his speech. There were several applause lines that he delivered, each requiring a good 30 seconds or so before he could continue his remarks. He still had a couple more to go when Van Damme appeared, directly below Ryan. He had a grave look on his face. It was hidden from view of the cameras, but he made a wrap-it-up motion by swinging a finger in a circle. Jack did just that, and fought for his happy face while he wondered what was going on. Van Damme's expression left no doubt. Bad news was coming. Normally, Ryan would exit through the hall at the end of a rally, and he'd take several minutes to shake hands and pose for pictures as he moved through his supporters. But Van Damme ushered him off stage right. The crowd cheered and the music blared as he headed off the stage, and he took the time to give one last big wave to everyone before heading out of view of the hall. In the hallway, Andrea Price O'Day shouldered up to him. Van Damme led the way toward a side exit.
"What is it?" Jack shouted to him. "Not yet, Jack,"
Arnie said as they walked briskly off the wings. The hallway was full of media and friends and supporters, and they moved through them quickly. Ryan's well-practiced smile was gone now. He rushed to catch up to his campaign manager.
"God damn it, Arnie, is it my family?"
"No, God no, Jack, sorry."
Arnie motioned for Jack to continue following.
"Okay."
Ryan relaxed a little. It was politics, that's all. They opened a side door and hurried out into a parking lot. Ryan's SUVs were parked in a row just ahead. More Secret Service met up with him, and Van Damme led the way to the waiting vehicles. And they almost made it. Within 20 feet of Ryan's SUV, a single reporter with a videographer in tow cut them off. Her microphone had the station ID of a local CBS affiliate. With no preamble, she pushed the microphone between two big Secret Service men and into Ryan's face.
"Mr. President, what is your reaction to the Attorney General's announcement of the murder investigation into your bodyguard?"
Ryan pulled up short. That the reporter had screwed up the facts only made the expression on Jack's face appear more confused. He turned to his lead Secret Service agent, Andrea Price O'Day, who was talking into her cuff mic to the drivers of the motorcade and therefore had not been listening to the question.
"Andrea's been charged with murder?"
"What?"
Ryan asked.
"John Clark, your former bodyguard, are you aware he is a fugitive from justice? Can you tell us the last time you spoke with him and the nature of your conversation?"
Ryan turned to Van Damme, who also fought off a deer in the headlights look. Arnie reached out and took Jack's arm, tried to lead him onto the vehicles. Quickly, Ryan recovered just enough to turn back to the reporter.
"I'll have a statement on this in a short while."
More questions came as the eager young reporter sensed that Ryan had no idea what the hell she was talking about. But Ryan said nothing else. He just hustled into the SUV behind his campaign manager. 20 seconds later, the SUV with Ryan, Van Damme, and Price O'Day pulled out as the door shut.
"What the fuck was that?"
Jack asked. Van Damme had his phone out already.
"Just got a heads up from D.C. Brannigan called a surprise press conference right before the 6 o'clock news and said Clark was being picked up on a murder rap. I found out from FBI he managed to escape the SWAT team that went to arrest him."
"What murder?"
Jack almost shouted.
"Something about his actions in the CIA. I am working on getting a copy of the arrest order from DOJ. I should have it in an hour." "This is politics. I gave the man a full pardon for his work at CIA just to prevent something like this from happening."
Ryan was yelling inside the car, the veins in his neck exposed.
"It is politics. Kilty's going after him to get to you. We need to treat this with kid gloves, Jack. We'll go back to the hotel, kibitz for a while, and make a statement that is careful. I'm going to get in front of the cameras right now and tell America what kind of a man Ed Kilty is picking on. This is bullshit."
"Jack, we don't know the details. If Clark has done something other than what you pardoned him for, it is going to look extremely bad."
"I know what Clark has done. Hell, I ordered him to do some of it."
Ryan thought for a moment.
"What about Chavez?" "He wasn't mentioned in Brannigan's press conference. I need to check on John's wife. Clark needs to turn himself in."
Jack shook his head.
"No, Arnie, trust me, he does not."
"Why not?"
"Because John is involved in something that needs to stay quiet. Let's just leave it at that. I will not go out on record with a call for Clark to come forward."
Arnie started to protest, but Ryan raised his hand.
"You don't have to like it, but you do have to drop it right now. Trust me.
Clark needs to stay low until this blows over.
If it blows over, Arnie said.
43. General Riaz Rehan entered the baked brick hut with two of Haqqani's men. They stood on either side of him holding flashlights, and they shined their beams on a figure slumped on the floor in the corner of the room. It was a man. Both of his legs were crudely bandaged, and he lay on the floor on his left shoulder facing the wall. The Haqqani operatives wore black turbans and long beards, but Rehan was in a simple salwar kameez and a short prayer cap. His beard was short and trim, contrasting dramatically with the two long-haired Pashtuns. Rehan looked over the prisoner. The man's matted and soiled hair was more than half gray, but this was not an old man. He was healthy, or he had been so before he'd been blown 10 feet by a rocket-propelled grenade. Rehan stood over the man for several seconds, but the man did not look toward the light. Finally, one of the Pashtun gunmen walked over and kicked the man on a bandaged leg. He stirred, turned to the light, tried to shield his eyes from it with his hands, then just sat up with his eyes closed. The wrists of the infidel were shackled to an eye bolt on the poured concrete floor, and his feet were bare. "Open your eyes," General Rehan said it in English. The Pakistani general motioned for the two guards to lower their flashlight beams a little, and when they did so, the bearded Westerner's eyes slowly opened. Rehan saw the man's left eye was blood red, perhaps from some blow to his nose or eye, but likely due to a concussion from the RPG blast that, Rehan had been told, caused the prisoner's other injuries. "So, you speak English, yes?" Rehan asked. The man did not answer at first, but after a moment he shrugged, then nodded. The general squatted down close to his prisoner. "Who are you?" No response from the prisoner. "What is your name?" Still nothing. "It hardly matters. My sources tell me you are a guest in Pakistan of Major Mohammed al-Darkur of the Joint Intelligence Bureau. You came here in order to spy on what Major al-Darkur erroneously thinks is a joint ISI Haqqani network facility." The wounded man did not respond. It was difficult to tell in the low light, but his pupils were still somewhat dilated from his concussion. "I would very much like to understand why you are here in Miran Shah right now. Is there something special you are hoping to find? Or was it just fate that has your journey into the federally administered tribal areas coincide with my visit here? Major al-Darkur has been meddlesome to my efforts of late." The gray-haired man just stared at him. "You, friend, are a very boring conversationalist."
"Been called worse."
"Ah, now you talk. Shall we have a polite discussion man to man, or shall I have my associates pry the next words past your tongue?"
"Do what you have to do. I'm going to catch a nap."
And with that, the American lay back on his side, his chains jangling on the concrete floor as he positioned himself. Rehan shook his head in frustration. "Your country should have stayed out of Pakistan, just like the British should have stayed away. But you inject yourselves, your culture, your military, your sin, into all cracks on the globe. You are an infection that spreads insidiously." Rehan started to say something else, but he stopped himself. Instead, he just waved an angry hand at the prostrate wounded man and turned to one of the Haqqani operatives. The American did not speak any Urdu, the native tongue of General Rehan. Nor did he speak much Pashto, the native tongue of the Haqqani network officer standing next to General Rehan. But Sam spoke English, so Rehan clearly intended for the prisoner to understand his command when he relayed it in English. "See what he knows. If he tells you willingly, execute him humanely. If he wastes your time, make him regret doing so." "Yes, General," replied the black-turbaned man. Rehan turned and ducked his head as he exited the baked brick cell. From his position on the floor, Driscoll watched him leave. When he was alone in the room, Sam said,
"You may not remember me, but I remember you, asshole."
44. John Clark stepped off the bus in Arlington, Virginia at 5:50 a.m. He kept the hood of his jacket over his head as he walked up North Pershing into a neighborhood that was still asleep. His target was in the 600 block of North Fillmore, but he would not go there directly. Instead, he continued on Pershing, ducked up the drive of a darkened two-story clapboard home, and followed the property line to the back fence. There he climbed over, dropped down into the dark, and followed this fence line until he made his way to the carport across the street from his target. He kept his eyes on the two-story whitewashed home on a zero-lot property in front of him,
crouched next to a garbage can with a violent cracking in his knees, and waited. It was cold this morning, below 40, and a wet breeze blew in from the northwest. Clark was tired. He'd been moving from place to place all night. A coffee shop in Frederick, a train station in Gaithersburg, a bus stop in Rockville, and then transfers to buses in Falls Church and Tyson's Corner. He could have traveled on a more direct route, but he did not want to arrive too early. A man walking through the streets early on a workday was less noticeable than a man strolling through a residential neighborhood in the middle of the night, especially when there were trained watchers about. From Clark's vantage point, here between a Saab four-door and a garbage can full of what John had determined to be soiled diapers, he could not see a surveillance crew monitoring the whitewashed wood home across tiny North Fillmore, but he imagined they were there. They would have determined there was a chance he'd come here to see the man who lived here, so they would have put one car with a two-person crew somewhere in a driveway on the street. The homeowner would have come out to see what the hell the car was doing there, but the watchers would have flashed their FBI creds, and that would have been the end of that conversation. He waited 22 minutes before a light came on in an upstairs window. A few more minutes, and a downstairs light flicked on. Clark waited some more. While doing so, he repositioned himself, put his butt down on the edge of the carport to allow the blood to flow back into his legs. He just adjusted to his new position when the front door of the home opened. A man in a windbreaker stepped out, stretched for a moment on the fence, and started up the street in a slow jog. Clark stood slowly in the dark and retraced his steps through the two backyards. John Clark made certain no one was following James Hardesty, CIA archivist, before he began jogging behind him. There were a few more men and women out for their pre-dawn, pre-workday exercise now, so Clark fit into the residential color. Or he would as long as the only illumination came from streetlights. John wore a black vinyl hooded jacket that wouldn't raise any eyebrows on a jogger, but his belted khaki chinos and his Vasca boots weren't typical attire for the other runners around here. He overtook Hardesty on South Washington Boulevard, just as he passed Towers Park on the right. The CIA man glanced back for an instant as he heard the jogger behind him. He moved to the edge of the curb to let the faster man pass, but instead, the man spoke.
Jim, it's John Clark. Keep running. Let's go up in the trees here and have a quick chat.
Without a word, both men ran up the little incline and stepped into an empty playground. There was just faint light in the sky enough to see faces close. They stopped by a swing set.
How's it going, John? I guess you could say I've been better.
You don't need that gun on your hip. Clark didn't know if the weapon was printing under his jacket or if Hardesty had just assumed.
I don't need it for you, maybe. Whether or not I need it has yet to be determined.
Neither man was out of breath. The jog had lasted less than a half mile. Hardesty said, "When I heard you were on the run, I thought you might come looking for me." Clark replied,
"The FBI probably had the same suspicions."
A nod.
"Yep. A two-man SSG team a half block up the street. They showed up before Brannigan went on the news."
The Special Surveillance Group was a unit of non-agent FBI employees who served as the Bureau's army of watchers.
Figured.
I doubt they'll come looking for me for a half hour or so. I'm all yours.
I won't keep you. I'm just trying to get a handle on what's going on.
DOJ has a hard-on for you big time. That's pretty much all I know. But I want you to know this. Whatever they got on you, John, they didn't get anything from me that wasn't in your file. Clark did not even know that Hardesty had been questioned.
The FBI interviewed you?
Hardesty nodded. Two senior special agents grilled me at a hotel in McLean yesterday morning. I saw some younger special agents in another meeting room interviewing other guys from the building. Pretty much everyone who was around when you were in SAD was questioned about you. I guess I warranted the first-string agents because Alden told them you and I go way back.
What did they ask?
All kinds of stuff. They had your file already. Guess those pricks Kilbourne and Alden saw something in there that they didn't like, so they started some sort of DOJ investigation.
Clark just shook his head. No.
What could be in my CIA record that would warrant CIA going out of shop like that?
Even if they thought they had me on some bullshit treason charge, they'd bring me in themselves before they breathed a word of it to DOJ.
Hardesty shook his head. Not if they had something on you that wasn't part of your CIA duties. Those fucks would sell you down the river because you were friends with Ryan. Shit, thought Clark. What if this wasn't about the campus? What if this was about the election?
What did they ask?
Hardesty shook his head but stopped it in mid-shake. Wait, I'm the archivist. I know, or at least I've seen, virtually everything in the virtual record. But there was one thing they asked me about that threw me for a loop.
What's that?
I know all your SAD exploits don't make it into the files, but normally there's a grain of something in the files that can link up to what you were actually working on, meaning I might not have a clue what a paramilitary operations officer did in Nigeria, but I can tell you if he was in Africa on a particular date. Malaria shots, commercial air travel, per diems that correspond to the location, that sort of thing.
Right.
But the two feds asked me about your activities in Berlin in March 1981. I went through the files. Hardesty shook his head.
Nothing.
Nothing at all about you being anywhere near Germany at that time. John Clark did not have to think back. He remembered instantly. He gave away nothing, just asked,
"Did they believe you?"
James shook his head.
Hell no.
Apparently Alden had told him to watch out for me because you and I have some history. So the feds pressed me. They asked me about a hit you did on a Stasi operative named Schumann. I told them the truth. I've never heard of any Schumann, and I didn't know a damn thing about you in Berlin in 81.
Clark just nodded, his poker face remaining intact.
The dawn filled out some of the features of Hardesty's face. The question John wanted to ask hung in the air for a moment, then Hardesty answered it unbidden.
I did not say one damn word about Henley Associates.
Hardesty was one of the few at CIA who knew of the existence of the campus. In fact, Jim Hardesty was the one who suggested Chavez and Clark go meet with Jerry Henley in the first place. Clark stared into the man's eyes. It was too dark to get a read on him, but, Clark decided, Jim Hardesty wouldn't lie to him. After a few seconds, he said,
"Thank you."
James just shrugged.
"I'll take that to my grave.
Look, John, whatever happened in Germany, this isn't going to be about you.
You're just a pawn.
Keelty wants to push Ryan into a corner on the issue of black ops. He's using you, guilt by association or whatever you want to call it. But the way he's having the FBI rummage through your past ops, pulling them out and waving them around in the air, stuff that ought to just be left right the fuck where it is. I mean, he's digging up old bones at Langley, and nobody needs that."
John just looked at him.
"You know and I know they don't have anything on you substantive. No sense in you making the situation any worse."
"Say what you want to say, Jim."
"I am not worried about your indictment. You are a tough guy." He sighed. "I'm worried you were going to get killed."
John said nothing.
"It makes no sense to run from this. When Ryan gets elected, this whole thing will dry up. Maybe, just maybe, you do a dozen months in a club fed somewhere. You can handle that."
"You want me to turn myself in?"
Hardesty sighed. "You running like this isn't good for you. It isn't good for American black ops. And it isn't good for your family."
Clark nodded now, looked at his watch. "Maybe I'll do that."
"It's best."
"You'd better get on home now before SSG calls it in."
The men shook hands.
"Think about what I said."
"I will." Clark turned away from Hardesty, stepped into the trees lining the playground, and headed for the bus stop. He had a plan now, a direction. He wasn't going to turn himself in. No, he was going to Germany. 45. Clark sat in the back of a CVS pharmacy in the Sandtown neighborhood of West Baltimore. It was a blighted part of the city, rife with crime and decay. But it was also a good place for Clark to lie low. Seated around him were locals, most old and sickly, waiting for their prescriptions to be filled. John himself kept his coat bunched up around his neck and his knit cap pulled down over his ears. It made him look like he was fighting a bad cold, but it also served to cover his facial features in case anyone around was looking for him. Clark knew Baltimore. He'd walked these streets as a young man. Back then, he had been forced to disguise himself as a homeless person while he tracked the drug gang who had raped and then murdered his girlfriend Pam. He'd killed a lot of people here in Baltimore, a lot of people who deserved to die. That was around the time when he joined the agency. Admiral Jim Greer had helped him cover up his exploits here in Baltimore so that he could work with the Special Activities Division. It was also the time when he'd met Sandy O'Toole, who later became Sandy Clark, his wife. He wondered where Sandy was right now, but he would not call. He knew she would be under surveillance, and he also knew Ding would be taking care of her. Right now, he needed to concentrate on his plan. John knew that as soon as the FBI missed him up in Emmitsburg, there would be a BOLO, a be-on-the-lookout order, broadcast among law enforcement agencies of the area, ensuring that everyone from traffic cops to organized crime detectives would have his picture and his description, and an order to pick him up if they saw him. In addition to this, Clark had no doubt the FBI was using its huge resources to hunt him down. He felt somewhat secure right now, in this place, with this semi-disguise and this low-profile action, but he knew he wouldn't last long before he was spotted. Though he sat with others in the pharmacy, he wasn't getting a prescription filled himself. Instead, he was watching the mirrors high at the back of the store, looking for anyone following him. For 10 minutes, he watched and waited, but he saw nothing. Next, he bought a throwaway phone at the pharmacy and wandered the store while he took it out of its packaging and turned it on. He then thumbed a 2-line text message to Domingo Chavez. He had no way of knowing if Ding was under surveillance himself, or exactly how far this had all spread, so he'd avoided Ding and the campus since finding out the FBI was looking for him the previous evening. But he and Chavez had established codes between the two of them, should a situation arise where one could not be certain the other was clean. A group of loud and rough-looking African-American teenagers entered Clark's aisle and immediately went silent. They gave him a long look, sizing him up like predators sizing up prey. Clark had been fumbling with his new phone, but he stopped what he was doing, stared back at the six youths just to let them know he was aware of their presence and their interest in him. This was more than enough to get the young toughs to move on to easier pickings, and John focused again on his work. John received a text message. 9 p.m., BWI okay? John nodded at the phone, then tapped back, okay. 3 minutes later, he walked north on Stricker Street, removing the battery from the phone as he did so. He tossed his empty coffee cup, the phone, and the battery in a drain culvert and continued walking. Seconds before 9 o'clock that evening, Domingo Chavez stood on the dark ramp in front of Maryland Charter Aviation Services. A cold rain fell on him, wetting the brim of his ball cap and causing a steady drip in front of his eyes. His windbreaker shielded him from the wet, but not the cold. 50 yards off his left shoulder, the Henley Associates Gulfstream G550 sat parked and ready, though at present it had filed no flight plan. Captain Reed and First Officer Hicks sat in the cockpit, and Adara Sherman readied the cabin, though they had no idea where they might be heading. Ding looked at his Luminox watch. The tritium gas-filled tubes glowed in the dark here just outside the residual lighting emitted by the aircraft 50 yards away. 9 o'clock, on the nose. Just then, a figure appeared out of the darkness. Clark wore a black hooded coat and carried no luggage at all. He looked like he could be an airport ground employee. Ding, he said with a curt nod.
How you holding up, John?
I'm okay.
Long day?
Nothing I haven't been through 100 times before. Doesn't usually happen in my own country, though.
This is fucking bullshit.
No argument here. Any news?
Chavez shrugged.
Just a little. The White House is using you to get to Ryan. No idea if they know about the campus or that you've been working at Henley Associates since retirement from the agency. The indictment has been sealed and no one is talking. If the existence of the campus is known or suspected, Kilty's people are tight-lipped about it. They are going about this like it's some cold case that just got a shake and your name fell out.
How about the family?
Sandy is fine. We are all fine. I'll watch out for them. And if someone comes for me, the Ryans will take over. Everyone sends their love and support.
Clark nodded, sighed out a burst of steam that shone in lights from the auxiliary power unit. Ding motioned to the Gulfstream.
And Henley sent this. He wants you to go into hiding.
I'm not going into hiding.
Chavez nodded thoughtfully.
You're going to need some help, then?
No, Ding. I need to do this alone. I want you at the campus. There's too much going on right now. I'll figure out who is behind this on my own.
I understand you want to keep the shop insulated, but let me come with you. Kathy Ryan will make sure Sandy is okay while we're gone. We make a hell of a team, and you're going to need me to watch your back.
Clark shook his head.
Appreciate it, but the campus needs you more than I do. The op-tempo is too high for both of us to be gone. I'll check in on back channels if I need a hand.
Chavez didn't like it. He wanted to be there for his friend. But he said,
Roger, John. The 550 will take you wherever you want to go.
You have a clean passport on board for me?
Now Ding smiled.
I do. Multiples. But I have something else on board in case you need to make a serious covert penetration to enter an area without leaving any paper trail whatsoever.
Clark understood.
Does Captain Reed know about that?
She does. And she will comply. Miss Sherman will get you set up.
Guess I'd better get going, then.
Good luck, John. I don't want you to forget. Any time, any place, you say the word and I appear on your shoulder. You got that?
I got it, and I appreciate it.
The men shook hands, and then they embraced.
Seconds later, John Clark headed to the Gulf Stream while Domingo Chavez watched him walk off in the rain. The Henley Associates Gulfstream flew to Bangor, Maine. This was not its final destination, but it served as a temporary staging area, a place to refuel and to wait until the next afternoon, when they would leave the country for Europe. John Clark did not leave the aircraft, though the crew did check into a local hotel to spend the balance of the evening and the next morning. Their original flight plan showed them heading to Geneva, but they would amend that in flight. The departure customs check at Bangor was a breeze, even though Clark's face had been on the news for the past 24 hours. His false mustache and toupee, along with his thick lens costume eyeglasses, made him unrecognizable as the man on television. At 5 p.m. on Wednesday, the G550 took off on runway 33, banked to the northeast, and began the long flight over the Atlantic. Clark had spent the day researching his target on a laptop on board the plane. He checked maps, train timetables, weather, yellow pages, white pages, and a never-ending list of German federal, state, and municipal government employee databases. He was looking for a man who might very well be dead, but a man who would be crucial in helping him uncover information about those targeting him. The 64-year-old former Navy SEAL slept a few hours while in flight, until his eyes opened to the sight of the short blonde hair and gentle smile of Adara Sherman looking over him. "Mr. Clark, it's time, sir." He sat up and looked out the window, saw nothing but clouds below them and a moon above.
"What's the weather like?"
"Cloud cover above 8,000 feet, temperature in the 30s on the deck." Clark smiled.
"Long underwear, then?"
Sherman smiled back. "Most definitely. Can I bring you a cup of coffee?"
"That would be great."
She turned for the galley, and Clark recognized for the first time how worried she was about what they were about to do. 15 minutes later, Captain Helen Reed came over the cabin intercom. "We are at 9,000 feet, beginning depressurization now." Almost immediately, Clark could feel pain in his ears and sinus cavity as the cabin depressurized. Clark had already dressed, but Adara Sherman put on her heavy double-breasted wool coat while sitting on the sofa next to him. She was careful to button all the buttons and to cinch the waist belt, and then secure it with a double knot. It was a fashionable coat by DKNY, but it looked a bit odd lashed down on her body like this. While she slipped her hands into her gloves, she asked, "How long since you've jumped out of a plane, Mr. Clark?"
"I've been jumping out of planes since before you were born."
"How long have you been avoiding answering difficult questions?"
Clark laughed. "About as long as I've been jumping. I'll admit it. I haven't done this in some time. I suppose it's like falling off a log."
Worry lines rimmed Sherman's eyes behind her glasses. "It's like falling off a log that is traveling at 120 miles an hour 7,000 feet above the ground."
"I guess you're right."
"Would you like to go over the procedure again?"
"No, I've got it. I appreciate your attention to detail."
"How is the arm?"
"It's not on my top 10 list of problems, so I guess it's fine."
"Good luck, sir. I speak for the crew when I say we hope you will call us anytime you need us."
"Thank you, Miss Sherman, but I can't expose anyone else to what I have to do. I hope to see you again when this is over, but I won't be using the plane during my operation."
"I understand." Captain Reed came over the PA. 5 minutes, Mr. Clark." John stood with difficulty. Strapped to his chest was a small canvas bag. It carried a wallet with cash, a money belt, two false sets of documents, a phone with a charger, a suppressed .45 caliber SIG pistol, four magazines of hollow point ammunition, and a utility knife. And strapped to his back was an MC-4 Ram Air parachute system. First Officer Chester Country Hicks stepped out of the cockpit, shook John's hand, and together, Hicks, Clark, and Adara moved to the rear of the cabin. There, Sherman raised the small internal baggage door, creating cabin access to the baggage compartment. Sherman and Hicks buckled themselves into wide canvas straps attached to the cabin chairs, and then they crawled, one at a time, into the tiny baggage hold. They had moved all the luggage into the cabin and lashed it to chairs earlier in the flight, so they had enough room to maneuver while on their knees. Adara moved to the right side of the external baggage door. Hicks took the left side. Clark remained in the cabin of the aircraft as the space was tight enough with two bodies in the cargo hold. He just dropped to his knees and waited. A minute later, First Officer Hicks glanced at his watch. He nodded to Sherman, and then the two of them pulled on the external baggage door from the inside. The hatch itself was only 36 by 38 inches, but it was very difficult to open. The external door was flush with the fuselage, just below the left engine,
and the airflow over the skin of the aircraft created a vacuum suction that the two crew members in the cargo compartment had to defeat with brute force. Finally, they got the door pulled in, a squeal as cold night wind rushed into the compartment. Once the door was inside, they slid it up like a tiny garage door, and this opened the 36 by 38 inch port to the outside. The port side jet engine was just feet away, and this created a raging noise that they had to scream over to be heard. Captain Reed had dropped them below the cloud cover as they approached their destination airport, Tegel, in Berlin. The earth below was black, with only a sprinkling of lights here and there. The hamlet of Kremen, northwest of Berlin, would be the closest concentration of development, but Clark and Reed had chosen a drop zone west of there because it contained a large number of flat, open fields rimmed by a forest that would be virtually empty on an early Thursday morning. Clark kept his eyes on Hicks in the luggage compartment in front of him. When the first officer looked up from his watch and pointed to Clark, John began counting backward from 20.
21,000. 19,000. 18,000.
He turned around, got on his hands and knees, and backed into the baggage hold. At 10,000, he could feel Adara and Chester's hands holding the straps of his parachute rig, and he could tell the toes of his boots were just outside the aircraft. Captain Reed would have slowed to 120 knots or so, but still, the jet noise and the pressure of the wind on his legs were intense. At 5,000, Clark had to shout it so the others could hear. Hicks let go of Clark's harness, and Sherman did the same, but she followed it with a quick squeeze on his shoulder. At 3,000, he backed farther out into the dark, cold wind. It was tough doing this backward, but head first would have been dangerous, and feet first, scooting out on his butt or back, would have increased the chances that his chute rig would catch on something inside the aircraft.
1,000, go!
Clark pushed his body out of the aircraft. Immediately he felt his right side slam against the threshold of the external baggage door, bruising his ribs. But he fell away and free of the Gulf Stream as it raced off in the night toward the lights of Berlin in the distance, leaving behind John Clark as he turned end over end, spinning downward toward fields of winter wheat some 7,000 feet below. 46. The oval table in the conference room on the ninth floor of Henley Associates was ringed with stern-faced men that Thursday morning. Sam Driscoll's and John Clark's seats were empty, but Domingo, Dominic, and Jack faced Jerry Henley and Sam Granger. Rick Bell, campus chief of analysis, begged off the meeting because he was focusing his energies on analyzing CIA and FBI traffic regarding the Clark investigation. Jerry assented to Bell's request, as it was in everyone's best interest that they got some sort of heads up in the event black trucks full of FBI tactical officers were on their way to the front door of their building. For the past 2 days, Henley Associates had been open for business, but the operators and much of the intelligence analysis staff had been instructed to stay home. Instead, the company functioned as a perfectly above-board trading and arbitrage shop, in case any of the intelligence the government was using in its sealed indictment on Clark also included information tipping off investigators about the real reasons behind Henley Associates. When no one came knocking on Tuesday or on Wednesday, Henley, Bell, and Granger made the decision to bring their men into work on Thursday. They had a very active and important investigation underway, with Sam Driscoll already out in the field, and plans to send the other operatives to Dubai to set up covert surveillance on Rian's property there. The first question of the morning was whether or not they could continue on with their investigation, or if they wanted to just pull up stakes, lie low for a while, and somehow try to support Clark. Dominic Caruso took a long sip of coffee and said, "We need to be here, in the States, and ready to move to support Clark. Do we even know where he is?" Granger said, "The Gulf Stream dropped him off just outside of Berlin. They will be back at BWI this evening and can fly you out to Dubai via Amsterdam tomorrow night." Ryan said, "Look, I understand the Dubai surveillance is important, but in light of recent events..." "Shit, we can't just leave John alone on this." Domingo shook his head. "He doesn't need us. He doesn't want us around. He's going to try and wiggle out of this mess on his own while we work our op. Don't lose sight of what we're working on, Jack. This is damn important." "I know. Look, John may be a bit long in the tooth, but he's also the most BTDT operator on the planet."
"BTDT?
"Been there, done that. Trust me, John Clark can handle himself. And if he needs support in the field, he will contact us. Look, you know I'd die for that man. But I also do what he tells me, especially at a time like this. I'm staying out of his way, going on with my job, and you are too. Okay, Mano?
Jack didn't like it. He couldn't understand how Dean could be so relaxed after everything that had happened. Still, he understood that Chavez had earned the right to call the shots on something involving John Clark. The two had been partners for 20 years, and Chavez was Clark's son-in-law as well.
Okay, Ding. Good. Now we've got today and tomorrow to get ready for our operation in Dubai, so that's what we'll do. Cool?
Caruso and Ryan were struggling with what they took as something of an abandonment of their mentor, but they could not argue with Chavez's logic. Clark could always send for them, even in Dubai. It would be hard for the men to concentrate on the Rihanna op, especially not knowing what might be still to come on the DOJ's Clark investigation, but they had a job to do, so they got down to it. The Oval Office of the President of the United States was not the actual command center for the FBI's operation to capture John Terrence Kelly, a.k.a. John Clark, but one could be forgiven for having that impression. Throughout Tuesday and into Wednesday, Ed Keelty saw a steady stream of repeat visits from Benton Thayer, Charles Alden, Mike Brannigan, Wes McMullen, and others focused on bringing in Clark. But by Wednesday afternoon, the FBI had decided their elusive bird had flown the coop. Keelty ordered Brannigan, Alden, and Thayer all into his office at the same time. By the president's way of thinking, he needed to turn up the heat on his own people. To that end, he subjected the group sitting on the couches to a 10-minute tongue-lashing that ended with a question delivered in a tenor just short of a scream.
How the hell does one man slip away like that?
Charles Alden said, "With respect, sir, that is what he does." Keelty replied,
"Ryan could be helping him run. Alden, go back to CIA and dig deeper. If you can find a tighter connection to Ryan and Clark, then we can implicate Ryan in Clark's flight."
Alden said, "I am told that some of what Jack Ryan did and much of what John Clark did was never committed to paper."
"Bullshit," Keelty said. "You're being lied to by your own people. Make examples of a couple of the key people and the others will open up."
"Tried that already, sir. These guys, the old guard, would rather hit the bricks than talk about John Clark."
"Fucking spooks,"
Ed Keelty said, waving away Alden's comment as he looked at Brannigan for a long moment. Finally, the president pointed at his AG.
"Listen to me, Mike. I want John Clark on the 10 most wanted list by the end of the day."
"Mr. President, there are a lot of concerns about that. Someone else, some terrorist or murderer or other dangerous man, will have to come off the list, and that is problematic as far as..."
"John Clark is a murdering, dangerous man. I want him on there."
Wes spoke up.
"I worry about how this is going to look to..."
"I don't give a good goddamn how it looks. I want this man caught. If he is a fugitive from justice, and if he has left the country, then we need to turn up the heat in any and all possible ways."
Brannigan asked, as respectfully as possible,
"Who shall I remove, sir? Which one of the top 10 will come off to put Clark on?"
"Your problem, Mike, not mine."
Benton Thayer said,
"Mike, sometimes there is a number 11, isn't there? Like when they don't want to take anyone off but feel someone else needs to go on."
The attorney general admitted, reluctantly, that Thayer was correct. The meeting broke up minutes later, but DDO Charles Alden asked Keelty directly if he could stay behind to talk to him for just a moment. He also asked that Thayer remain in the Oval Office. This was a breach of protocol for a meeting with the chief executive. Wes McMullen, the president's chief of staff, should have been approached by Alden if he wanted more time with the president. Wes was standing right there. He had been ignored, and he was determined to nip this in the bud.
"Guys, the president has a 1:30 Rose Garden stand-up with a..."
"Wes," Keelty said, "it's okay. Just give us a few minutes."
McMullen was as suspicious as he was frustrated, but he did as his boss told him and left the room, closing the door behind him. Keelty sat on the couch with Alden and Thayer facing him. By looking at both men, he recognized immediately that his campaign manager did not know what was about to be discussed.
"What is it, Charles?"
Alden drummed his fingers on his knees while he carefully chose his words.
"Mr. President, some information has come into my possession that makes me believe there is credible evidence that this Clark character was involved in the capture of the Emir."
Thayer and Keelty both sat there with their mouths slightly open. Softly, Keelty said,
"What the hell are you talking about? What evidence, and why am I just hearing about this?"
"To insulate you, Mr. President, I think it's best that I don't say anything else." But Keelty shook his head.
"Justice says the Emir was likely dumped on us by a foreign intelligence agency. Do we believe now that Clark is spying for another country?"
Alden shook his head. "That is not Clark.
I've read every scrap of paper that's ever been written about the son of a bitch. Not in a million years would he work for a foreign power. Thayer leaned in closer. Then what the fuck is he? He must be, working for someone here. Someone waving the flag, but not CIA. Definitely not CIA. What are you not saying? The FBI did not get any wind of what Clark was working on from CIA. But within the FBI itself, there are faint rumors about an off-the-books organization stocked with certain analytical and operational capabilities. Like a private spy shop. FBI has suspicions that some in their house know about it, but getting any concrete evidence is like nailing Jell-O to the wall. Edward Keelty literally gasped. You are talking about a shadow government? Some sort of sub rosa American enterprise? Nothing else makes a damn bit of sense, Alden said. Benton Thayer was slower than the other two. He had no experience with either the military or intelligence communities, and hadn't thought much about how they were organized. But he did understand one aspect. The Emir will know if Clark captured him. We get the Emir to ID him, and then Clark is fucking toast. And if Clark goes down, then Jack Ryan goes down with him. Keelty was still gobsmacked by this new information, but he retained the presence of mind to say, The Emir is under lock and key, with DOJ restrictions on the intel he can provide. Thayer just shook his head. You are the President of the United States. Just tell Brannigan to loosen the reins on the PCI. We can get everything we need. Keelty, the consummate political animal, thought of a new angle to his problem. But the Emir is the most unsympathetic witness we could possibly have on our side in this. So what if he IDs Clark? Then Clark comes off looking like a hero for capturing the man. Think about it. Does it bother us that there may be some sort of off-the-book spy shop out there? Fuck yes. But is the 10th District of Ohio, or the 3rd District of Florida, or any one of the other battleground states going to support the trial of the guy who caught the Emir? I don't see it. Alden shrugged. We don't care if Clark goes to prison for this, but we can implicate Ryan. If Clark is involved, maybe Ryan is involved as well. Think about it. Who else would Clark work for on something as shady as an off-the-books intelligence house? Keelty said, We will need Clark in hand to answer that question. We can offer him limited immunity or even total immunity to dump this on Jack Ryan. Alden nodded. I like it. But Keelty then said, But without Clark, we are dead in the water. Alden looked to Thayer now. May I have 1 minute alone with the president? Thayer just nodded without checking with Keelty himself. He felt incredibly out of his depth, and he had a suspicion something was about to happen that he would not want to be involved in. So he rose from the couch and headed straight out of the office, closing the door behind him.
Chuck?
Ed Keelty leaned forward, almost whispered. Mr. President, just between you and me, I can get John Clark. We need him alive. I understand. Keelty started to speak, his mouth open to utter the word, how, but he stopped himself. Instead, he just said,
Just between you and me, Chuck. Do it.
Alden rose, and the two men shook hands with hard looks between them. Nothing else was said before the deputy director of the CIA left the Oval Office. 47. Deputy Director of the Central Intelligence Agency, Charles Alden, reached Paul Laska just after midnight. The old man was home in his bed, but he'd given Alden a number that would allow him to be contacted, no matter the hour.
Hello.
Paul, it's Charles.
I did not expect to hear from you. You told me you wouldn't get involved past what you've already done.
It's too late for that. Keelty has pulled me in.
You can refuse him, you know. He won't be president for much longer.
Alden thought this over for a moment. Then he said, It's in everyone's interest that we capture John Clark. We have to find out who he's working with, how he managed to catch the Emir, who the other people are in his group.
I understand Mr. Clark has left the United States and the CIA is working on this overseas.
Your network of intelligence assets rivals my own, Paul. A slight chuckle from the old man in his bed.
What can I do for you?
I am worried that despite my wishes and intentions, my colleagues at the Central Intelligence Agency will be disinclined to put the full might of their powers into the hunt for John Clark. The rank and file reveres the man. I've got everyone hunting for him, but these are hunters who are just going through the motions. And Keelty, is on one hell of a time constraint. After a long pause, Laska said, You would like my help in bringing in outsiders to do the work that needs to be done.
That is it exactly. I know someone who can help us. I thought you might. Fabrice Bertrand Morel.